The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
It's going very well. Now, we'll talk about more serious matters in a moment, but let's start on a light note, but it's also about heaviness. Pets getting heavier during the pandemic.
That does intrigue people. Many people have pets, as we know, Pat. So there's a big study just out showing that obesity could be a risk factor now for pets in terms of getting obese during the pandemic. And 71% of vets have said they're worried about pets putting on weight, basically, during this pandemic. And there's evidence for this. About a third of pet owners have said they've seen their pets put on more weight. And of course, it's a risk factor for many diseases in animals, just as it is in humans. You know, obesity is a negative. So of course, the vets are slightly worried about it, I guess. And what was interesting was, Pat, it was mainly to do with people being at home and giving their pets too many treats. There's a temptation to show some love, I suppose, for your pet, and they were given too many treats to the pets. But it's something the vets are flagging up as a concern.
I'm sure there are some pets, though, who are almost worn to the bone because of all the walks they're getting.
that's the strange thing. They got the opposite. Often when you're doing analysis, you get the opposite of what you might expect. People thought, oh, they might put on less weight because of all the exercise, but that doesn't seem to be the case. There's been less exercise in one study with pets, strangely, but you might think you'd be pounding the streets with your dog, wouldn't you? But that doesn't seem to be the case necessarily. 49% of pet owners in this survey said they're happy to go on a diet to help their pets lose weight. Wasn't that interesting? Another one is giving too many scraps from the table. That's another factor they think in this as well, which doesn't help. So the advice from vets is try to bring your dog for a walk and give them less treats and less scraps from the table.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, whatever about dogs, and you do bring them for walks. I mean, if you've got a cat and you're not normally there during the day, and you've got the cat, and the cat is on your lap, and you're working away on your screen, and then you have your coffee, and you say, well, I can't leave the cat out of things. Better give the cat a treat as well. And so it goes. Anyway, let's get on to more serious matters. IL-6, what is
that? That's right. Yeah, this is a good one now, because this massive trial in the UK, it's called REMCAP, where they're testing lots of different drugs that are used for other diseases. And dexamethasone, remember this one, that came out of that trial. Dexamethasone is a steroid that's anti-inflammatory. And that trial showed dexamethasone was reducing mortality, probably by about a fifth, one in five were being saved by that. But now, a drug for arthritis, of all things, is called tocilizumab. These drug names are often very challenging. And a second drug that's similar, it's called sarilumab. Both of these block a cytokine called IL-6. Now, IL-6 is a very inflammatory protein in your body. And you see it in arthritis and joints, in the rheumatoid joint, for instance, loads of IL-6 around. And you block it in arthritis, and these drugs are beneficial, you see. And then in COVID, of course, there's inflammation in your lungs. So they thought, let's try and block IL-6 there. They saw lots of IL-6 in the COVID-19 lungs. And now the trial has worked, but it's shown a 25% decrease in mortality for people on either one or the other drug. And it was quite a big trial. Over 400 patients were tested, you know. So it's pretty good. It's really compelling evidence, I think, that blocking IL-6 could be beneficial. It was patients who were quite severe. And when then the severity began, that means they were put on some kind of support. That's when to start the drug, 24 hours. Within 24 hours of going on some kind of organ support, they call it, give them this. And it does indeed impact on mortality. So it's yet another medicine to use in our hospitals, I guess.
Now, they are working on ways to check whether you've got COVID-19 by using a saliva swab, you know, a cheek swab, rather than having to go down your throat or up your nose. But saliva has another important role as a marker of how you might progress in COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're trying to get away from what's called the nasopharyngeal test, which is sticking, as you say, up the nose, down the throat. That test is quite uncomfortable. Of course, it still should be done by people, by the way. It's not that bad, you know. But people have had that, say, oh, it's a little bit uncomfortable. So the big question is, can you replace it with a cheek scrape or some saliva? And now a really nice study shows saliva is a great predictor of disease. You can measure viral load in saliva more effectively, which is good as well. And then it correlates very well with the severity and mortality. So there's talk now of replacing the nasopharyngeal swab test now with a saliva test. And it was a very nice piece of science. They could correlate the level of virus in the saliva with IL-6, actually, the one we just mentioned, for instance. Other markers of disease were correlating, you know, much better than with the nasopharyngeal swab. So if anything, saliva might be superior than the nasopharyngeal approach. And now, of course, as we've discussed before, we have to move to universal testing, don't we? And saliva, yet again, is shown to be a really effective sort of place to start with it.
Yeah, I just referred to that universal testing. I mean, yesterday we saw that the HSE was calling back people who had been a close contact of a positive case, but were asymptomatic, but they were told, isolate at home, don't come into work. And I put it to the minister, Stephen Donnelly, that using this universal testing, the antigen testing, on a daily basis for those sensitive kind of staffs in sensitive locations, not your builders outside on the scaffolding, but, you know, people going into nursing homes, people going into hospitals. And he didn't seem terribly enthusiastic about it. There was supposed to be a pilot done. Didn't get any information from him on that. I'm just wondering, what is the problem with this?
I don't know. I mean, the big question of it is when this lockdown is lifted, which will probably be mid-February, we think, really, don't we? They should introduce universal testing, shouldn't they? I mean, now's the whole idea of a lockdown is to make sure when you come out of it, you do something better. You don't just go back to the way it was, because that risks another lockdown, you know? So why they can't ramp up testing in this phase now even more, and especially this universal antigen test, that'll be a tremendous addition in terms of what we're trying to do here. So it is a mystery, isn't it? And all the evidence says this is extremely useful, including this saliva test, you know? So we should really keep pressing that and hope something happens, really.
Yeah, we've been pressing and pressing and pressing, but I have to say, to no avail. And I'm mystified. I'm absolutely mystified as to why they're not doing it. But anyway, we'll attempt to get answers as best we can. Now, the AstraZeneca vaccine, you know, when you get the Pfizer or Moderna, because of the two reactions initially in Britain, I think it was, to Pfizer, we had people who went into some sort of reaction, could have been anaphylactic shock. Turned out that they were carrying EpiPens anyway. You're advised to hang around for 15 minutes to make sure you're not going into any kind of shock reaction. AstraZeneca will not require this waiting period.
That's right. Yeah, there's no allergic reactions yet reported for the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is good. Now, as you said, Pat, it's rare with the Pfizer one, but still it was seen in a small number of people. And that gave rise to the recommendation to wait a bit longer, you know. But with this one, AstraZeneca have said there's no need to wait. So as soon as you have the vaccine, you can leave, you know. Now, that is a big effect, because the net number of people, the throughput per unit time then can be much faster. So that's another example of, in terms of how that vaccine could be very, very effective, you know, for us all. Because you can imagine waiting for 15 minutes is a bit of a chore, especially in a GP surgery, obviously, you see. So if you just vaccinate,
I mean, you'd be told to go back out to your car or hang out in the street or whatever, because you can't keep people who potentially could be infected, you can't keep them in a small waiting room together. That's another issue.
That's right. Yeah, it's just a bit of an extra thing to do, you see. So we don't need to do that. That makes it more convenient. And of course, what's happening, Pat, in the UK, the GPs are now doing the vaccinations is the first thing more and more. And pharmacies are about to start vaccinating in the UK as well. And they will, with the Pfizer one, they will keep people for 15 minutes or keep an eye on them, you know. But again, with AstraZeneca, there's no need. So this is seen as an important one, because it makes the whole thing much more convenient.
Now, one of my texters, Mary by name, a News Talk listener, says, can you ask Luke about the Florida doctor who died 16 days after getting the Pfizer vaccine? Johns Hopkins University thinks more than likely a severe reaction to the Pfizer vaccine. And I've just checked out the New York Times story on it. And it says a Florida physician developed an unusual blood disorder shortly after he received the Pfizer vaccine. It's not yet known if it's linked. He got an unusually severe blood disorder 16 days after the vaccine. He's an obstetrician and gynecologist, 56 years of age, got the vaccine at Mount Sinai Medical Center on December the 18th, died 16 days later from a brain hemorrhage. And they talk about it being an acute immune thrombocytopenia.
Yeah. Yeah, that does happen, but it could be a complete coincidence. You know, clearly that man might have had that anyway. Like a single person having some reaction like that could be a completely coincidental event. You know, they would record it, of course, and that's the important thing. They record all these things. If that's seen again, and if more have it, then you know there could be something going on. But it's just a correlation there. I suspect that would have happened to that poor guy anyway. It doesn't mean the vaccine caused it, you know.
Hmm. And also, there is advice on any of the vaccines if you have a known allergy to vaccines, if you have a known allergy to any of the components of the vaccine. And I presume when you go to get your vaccine, you will be interrogated. And that's why you really have to have trained people who are kind of introducing you to the vaccine. You'll
that's
be
right.
asked, do you have a, you know, are you allergic to whatever it might be? I won't mention substances for fear people jump up and down.
Exactly.
And
say
they
can't that condition, that guy had 15 people per million have that anyway in the population. You know, that would happen to that thrombocytopenia thing. So in other words, he just could have been one of those 15 anyway. The vaccine didn't necessarily cause that. It's only one person, you see, so you can't get too worried about that. But as I say, it's important to record it and then just to see if it happens with other people. But so far, that's a single case. Now, remember, I think something like 8 million people have had this Pfizer vaccine at the moment, you know, and there's one case, you know, so then it doesn't alarm us too much.
OK. Now, latest from Israel, because they've been touted as being the most successful country in the world at vaccinating people. What are we hearing?
Yeah, they're like I call them the canary in the coal mine, because they're now vaccinated. They've 2 million people have been vaccinated. And of course, they're watching those people very closely for the risk of reinfection and spread and all kinds of things, you know. And there's a couple of very good things. But one is there's the first evidence we have now that Pfizer vaccine may well block transmission. And that was a big question. You know, there was in one study there was a 33% decrease in transmission of the virus post-vaccination, which is a really good sign if that holds up, because now we have a vaccine that stops you getting sick. But secondly, it will slow down transmission of the virus. Now, if that holds up, that's tremendous news, because then the R number really begins to fall. Now, again, it's a work in progress. There's three separate studies looking at this in real time. A second one is they've followed 800,000 people now with the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine. And there's 50% efficacy from the first dose, which is good. You know, now what that means is they need the second dose to get to the 90%. But still, 50% efficacy from a single shot is not a bad thing. But it does tell us that the second shot is needed really to boost it up to 90%. So in other words, it's being tested in the field, you know, like in a real situation. And the numbers are holding up, which is tremendous. You know, so again, we're getting loads of data from Israel all the time about how the Pfizer vaccine works in real life as opposed to in a clinical trial.
It's interesting. 73% of Israelis who are over the age of 60 or who have other high risk factors have already been vaccinated with at least one shot. So shows you the pace of it. Absolutely incredible. Slower in Arab and ultra-Orthodox communities, whether they have vaccine hesitancy. You'd imagine the ultra-Orthodox people would certainly be high on the list. You'd have your doubts about the Arab community being treated the same way. But it must be down to vaccine hesitancy, because if the Arabs are Israeli citizens, they would have the same rights as anybody else.
Yeah, there is hesitancy, and they're trying very hard now, by the way, to counter the hesitancy in those two communities to try and get those people vaccinated. Because the goal here, remember, Pat, like everywhere, is to get 80% coverage of the population. Has to happen, be the ultimate goal. You know, yeah, they've hit 2 million people. It's amazing, isn't it? They say they're going to get to 5.2 million by March 20th. Which will be remarkable for that country to achieve that. That's kind of 2/3 of the population. They're almost at the 80% by March, April time. They've achieved that, you see. So they really are ahead of everybody else.
Yeah. Now, they've had obviously another partial lockdown, I think, because, you know, until you get enough to have herd immunity, there's still going to be virus circulating, and people who are vulnerable will still get it. I noticed, by the way, that in Britain, they're talking about having 24-hour vaccination centres. In other words, 24-hour, all day, every day, you can walk up, cycle up, drive up or whatever, and get vaccinated when the supplies are available. That's what they're saying. Now, questions from our listeners again. Is one safe from the virus once you have had the first vaccination? Now, you've been referring to that. That's from George in Cork. But when you talk about 50% protection in the case of Pfizer in Israel, does that mean that you're going to get a half dose of the virus? Or does it mean that half the people who got the vaccine are still susceptible?
That's right. Yeah. Overall, it means that there's still a risk of getting infected. You know, you've got a 50% decreased risk, but some people still get infected after vaccines. We know there's other vaccines are like that. No vaccine is 100%. There's always going to be a percent of people who don't get protection from it. Now, 50% is good, but I mean, the flu vaccine is 50, 60% anyway, but people still get the flu after that vaccine, remember. But of course, the advice is take the vaccine. If you want to have your risk of something, you will do what the advice is, I guess. Now, that's why if we get to 90%, that's tremendous, because then you've got massive coverage. And then, as you say, Pat, the goal is herd immunity, so-called. The more people that get vaccinated, the better it is for everybody, you know.
What are the side effects expected from the four vaccines to be used here, the fourth one being Johnson & Johnson? But, of course, they may import other vaccines, the Sputnik, the Sinovac, whatever. You know, there will be lots coming to market.
There will be indeed. Yeah. Well, again, they're all quite similar. You know, you do get this sort of muscle pain from the injection site. You might expect to get maybe a slight temperature. It turns out the Pfizer vaccine has been less troublesome in that regard. On the trial, they were reporting a higher percent of people having sort of, you know, mild enough symptoms that last a day or so. But when it's in the wild again and in the real world, there's less of that going on, which is interesting, you know. So, but you would expect to see a few reactions post vaccination. And then the risk of severe side effects is extremely rare, which is great news. Now, there are some. We must be upfront about this. You can see this in the reports. You know, you do see this Bell's palsy. There's a tiny risk of that, you know. But these other effects are not sufficient enough to stop us using the vaccines by any means.
Yeah. I mean, Bell's palsy, when you get it and, you know, you get it from a draft from an open window, can leave your face distorted for a while. But it does resolve and you go back to normal.
Exactly.
Now, another one here. Have you heard of the new nitric oxide nasal spray approach to stop the coronavirus taking hold in the nasal cavity? That's from John in Limerick.
No, I haven't heard that one. There are several sprays being tested. You see an ad on the telly, actually, Pat, for sprays to stop the common cold off your nose, you know. Mm. So there are various sprays that are being tested in various ways. They're never seen as the complete answer because obviously there'll be different levels of response and so on. But they may well be an addition. You never know, to decrease risk a bit more. You know, everything might help a little bit, you see. But and there are one or two on the market already. I haven't heard of that one, though. That's a new one. Yeah, nitric oxide.
Now, this question, again, it's probably applies to a lot of people. My wife and I are both over 80 and with underlying conditions. If we both get a vaccine with 60% efficacy, there's only, you know, 40% chance that both of us will be protected. If, no, he says a 36%. If the vaccine is 95% effective, our chances are 90% protection. He's multiplying the two, I think, one by the other.
Yeah, it gets a bit statistical. Yeah, it's a bit tricky. These numbers come from thousands of people and the average response and stuff like that, you know, so it's quite hard to talk about individuals. There's still a chance anybody might get reinfected, you know, so it's a population-wide numbers where they get these percentages from, really.
Yeah, guys, you have two people living together, and if they one gets vaccinated, well, that person has protection. If the other gets vaccinated, that person has protection, up to the level of the efficacy of the vaccine. Yeah. But the fact that the two of them are living together, I would imagine they're pretty well protected.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the point about this is if you're given a chance of decreasing your risk of something, even by 50%, you should take that because it's a big effect on the risk of you doing anything. You know, this all about decreasing risk is what this is all about, really.
Yeah. Now, Paddy, the News Talk texter who texted in that, is suggesting that older people should be given the vaccine that has the highest efficacy, the highest protection rate. You know, we know that one shot of AstraZeneca initially gives you 50% protection or whatever, and then, or 60%, then you, with the second shot, you get way up there to 90-something. And he's saying older people should get the one that gives the most protection.
They're all good. Moderna is over 90%. AstraZeneca may well get to 80-90%. Remember, one of the trials that it did get to 90%, you see. So I think AstraZeneca is up there with them, you know. And then Johnson & Johnson, actually, last night, they issued some initial data. That could well be 70-80% as well. Once you're in that 70-80-90%, there's always an error bar on these numbers, you know. They're all pretty similar, those vaccines. But they're right. I mean, if you'd a vaccine at 50%, you might prefer to get one that's higher, wouldn't you? And certainly if you're in a high-risk group, you might as well go for the best one.
And a couple of more things. What about extending the time between the first and second vaccinations as done in the UK? Would it still be effective? And Joe Biden talking about the same thing, releasing all the Pfizer vaccine they have available to them on the basis that they probably will have security of supply anyway, but they might have to extend the gap between first shot and second shot if they don't have an adequate supply.
I guess they've no data on that. The trial mandated 21 days between the two doses, and that's where the evidence came from. But if you went beyond that by a couple of weeks, that shouldn't have a big effect. The immune system would still be able to do its job, you see, if you delay it by like 2, 3, 4 more weeks, maybe. It's a bit of an unknown, though. I think you're better off following the protocol that was established in the trials, really. But if there wasn't a supply issue, you could delay it by a few weeks. There are studies actually showing leaving a bit longer might work better. Not with this vaccine, with other ones, you know. So it's not the worst thing in the world to delay it by a few weeks. But if you go beyond that, then you might be in trouble because the first dose might wane too much, you see. That's a slight concern there.
Yeah, and then you're starting from square one again. Another one, Jens in Clonakilty. Are there or should there be dogs here in Ireland which can sniff out COVID-19? It works in Finland.
Yeah, that I think we spoke about that a few months ago. There's lots of studies on dogs now being very good at detecting the virus. It's incredible. They've got such a fantastic sense of smell. And yep, some airports are deploying dogs. A bit like drug trafficking, I suppose. Dogs can sniff that out as well. So dogs are part of it in many ways. Yeah. And that gets on to our next concern, Pat, when we reopen, is the travel business. What are we going to do with the airports? Now why not have dogs in the airports to help track down people who are positive? But that's a good idea.
Good idea. All right. Quick one. Can you ask Luke, are my 8-year-olds allowed out to play with friends at level 5?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, again, I think exercise is fantastic. You know, I don't know about, again, you'd be maintaining a bit of distance, I suppose. But playing is a good thing in the open air. Definitely. Yeah.
Can you ask Luke about the emerging new symptom of a blocked ear, which I had Christmas 2019 for about 5 to 6 weeks, tested positive Easter Sunday 2020 after getting swabbed 3 weeks earlier on March 23rd. That's from Andrew in Cork.
Yeah, you get those kind of symptoms with any respiratory disease. People with the cold can sometimes have those kinds of symptoms, you know, so that wouldn't be an unusual thing, I don't think. Nobody's flagged that up as being especially severe, say, so it wouldn't be that worrying, I don't think.
Is it likely to be like the flu vaccine, we'll need a new one every year, from Patrick?
Well, yeah, that's the other big question, of course. We may not. I mean, it depends on if this virus mutates, which is a big discussion at the moment. But again, I think at worst, it'll be every winter like the flu vaccine, potentially. You know, and we could live with that, couldn't we? It'd be an add-on to the flu vaccination campaign, I guess.
All right. And a final one. Please ask Luke if it's safe and or possible for a healthy 84-year-old to be vaccinated after being told yesterday that she was a close contact of someone who's positive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the key thing now, as we know, is get the vaccine into all the vulnerable elderly groups combined, really. So that'll be fine.
Yeah. Even if she was kind of brewing up the infection, because that
really
would
matter.
Be the suspicion. Doesn't matter. Yeah, get the vaccine
really
into the arm.
Absolutely.
All right, Luke, thank you very much for joining us with all that COVID-19 news. Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin.